is good. Thanks, Sega. Thanks, Sega.
Welcome, Sega fans, and especially Sega Saturn fans, and especially those listening to us on Radio Sega. It's the Sega guys. We're back again for 2022, and with me, he's the Tom Kalinske to my Hayao Nakayama, although we do have a little bit of a better relationship. It's James the Sega Holic. How you doing, mate?
I'm blowing, mate. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. I hope you had a good one, mate. Do anything exciting?
Absolutely nothing, mate. Quiet time with the family. Few long weekends off over Christmas and New Year. And here we are getting ready to get back into the grind and the old the podcast routine and hopefully get the output increased for the new year, because as much as we enjoyed 2021 and we had some landmark guests on there, you know, Mr. Kalinske, Al Nelson, Blake J. Harris, you know, landmark moments for us as a podcast, but we want to get that output, you know, increased in 2022, and we've got some exciting plans. So yes, listeners, a happy new year to you also, all you people listening on Radio Sega and via Podbean, Spotify, you know, Apple Podcasts, whatever you get the podcast from the Gout in our stream. Hope you had a good one, and we are raring to go, and we've got lots planned for 2022, so stay tuned.
Raring to go indeed, mate, and I think we've both had this one on the boiler for some time, and it's kicking off the new year in big style. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be a great year, I think. Hopefully we get a lot more episodes out there. We've got a few guests already lined up, some good guests that we're hoping to get on last year, which hopefully we'll get on this year. Some great My Favourite Sega guests coming in. But this is a big, probably our most ambitious series. It was going to be four parts until we realised that the first part would probably be so big we'll have to start it in two. And that is, of course, if you want to tell our listeners what today's episode is going to be about.
This is part one of the Saturn years. This originally was, if you remember back, we had the Chronicles series. We've done Virtua Fighter. We had a great run of that. We've done all the Sega console Virtua Fighter games. However, we thought, you know, because I think Chronicles wouldn't have really grasped it. I don't think that kind of title on its own did justice to what we were wanting to do. We were looking to capture a specific moment in time, and to go over the trials, the tribulations, the history, the lifespan, the games, the experiences of the Sega Saturn. So being both Dan and I's favourite, you know, Sega console, the Saturn years is what we've decided to call it, and this is part one, and it is going to be more of a bit of a history lesson, maybe talking back to some, you know, recent revelations that have come out from Hideki Sato. The interview that's come out recently about that has added some extra flavour to this episode. We did have the notes down for it, but then that came out and you and I just sat there and went, oh, this is gold.
Yep.
Because it just tied in so beautifully to add that extra bit of body into the, I sound like Gordon Ramsay, flavour body, you know. Where's the lamb sauce? It was just a gold mine to see that stuff coming out. This is the kind of, we're calling this sort of like year zero, I suppose, because we are going to be talking about the development cycle and the kind of history and relationship between Sega and Sony that kind of all happened before, obviously, Sony went down the route of the PlayStation, and we all know what happened with the Saturn, but we'll come to all that stuff later on. This is year zero of the Saturn years.
That's right, mate. And obviously, Saturn years, it may sound familiar because, sorry, Andrew, we did have to borrow the Dreamcast years just for this series. I hope we do you proud, mate. But yeah, year zero, mate. We both wanted to do, you know, year one when we did this was going to be, okay, we'll talk about the development and we'll talk about the first wave of games. But it turned out that the development of the Saturn is just so in-depth and just so interesting that year zero, going up to the Japanese launch in 1994, just had to be its own show, didn't it?
Yeah, no, 100%. I think we try and keep our shows to about 90 minutes. I know we've got that two-hour slot on Radio Sega, but I think if we had covered, you know, year zero up until the Japanese launch and then went from, you know, going talking about the launch games and the kind of initial Japanese period and then perhaps try to take it through to the PAL launch, I think there would have been a bit of kind of blurring of the lines there, and I think we could have gone for like 2+ hours. So I think this is a nice, the way we've laid it out, I think is kind of cut quite nicely, and it will flow quite well, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, we were talking about the years. 1995 is just full of humdingers anyway, which we have mentioned before, but we will get to 95 in due course. But we talk about this one as if it's 1994. Project Saturn actually started way back in 1991, which does seem a little bit crazy. But then I don't know if you've ever seen that graphic, mate, of all the Sega consoles. They've got the Mark 1, the SG-1000, the Mark 2, the Mark 3, the Master System, the Game Gear. It's like every year Sega are releasing hardware. It's no surprise that Sega was so prolific, especially since the concept of a generational cycle, as we kind of know it today. Nowadays, you know, you've got Gen 9 now? Your PlayStation 5s and your Xbox Series consoles, PS4 and Xbox One was Gen 8. But during this period, after the Mega Drive had launched, the generational cycle hadn't really been established. And if you think of, you know, the Mega Drive at this point was 3 years old, the Mega CD add-on had just been launched, and Sega were probably quite rightly thinking, okay, what's the true successor going to be to the Mega Drive that's going to be better than the SNES, better than the Mega CD? And yeah, they had a couple of prototypes that accepted both game cartridges and CDs at this stage.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing as well. You're talking about like generational cycles as well there, Dan. It's like, you consider the gap between the Japanese launch of the Mega Drive and the PAL launch. You know, like, we're putting out happy 30th birthday tweets and there's folk going, no, it's 31 years. It's just, you know, madness. So, yeah, I mean, you're looking at it there. It's mental to see that really that kind of generation did kick off, you know, what we've come to know now is the kind of traditional maybe 5 to 6 years, maybe 4, 5, 6. I think the PS3 and 360 generation kind of threw things out a wee bit because that lasted an insane amount of time compared to previous generations and even, you know, looking back before that. But yeah, just the fact that, again, Sega were trying to kind of hedge their bets on, you know, will we stick with consoles? Will we move to CD? They had, obviously, the Mega CD would come later. And again, even if you look forward, you know, before Saturn, it's almost as if they were sort of, you know, maybe toying with the idea, because the 32X used cartridges, Mega CD was obviously CD. So it's even as late on as that, you're talking about 91 Project Saturn, and they were looking at CDs and cartridges, they had prototypes for both. And yet, you're looking at it and going, well, later on, you're still maybe not 100% sure what direction as a company you're wanting to go in, because you're still toying with peripherals that do both things attached onto the Mega Drive. So the confusion was obviously still kind of ongoing for years well after 91.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think of 1991, the Mega CD had just launched in Japan. Wouldn't come to Europe until 93, so it took a little while to come over here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think he put it in perspective. The Mega Drive launched in Japan in 1988, and you know, it wasn't successful in that period. And to be honest, it did okay in America, and it did well in Europe, but in America it was still kind of playing second fiddle to the NES, in fact, until Tom Kalinske came. And 1991 is often considered the relaunch of the Sega Genesis, isn't it? I think Tom used those words he's used them at some point, that it was kind of a relaunch. Mm-hmm. So whereas Sega Japan they've tried the SG-1000, that didn't work, we'll go with the Mark II, okay, that's not caught on, we'll try the Mark III, we'll try the Master System, we'll try the Mark V or Sega Mega Drive, it ultimately became. 3 years on, they're thinking, okay, we need to replace this. Lo and behold, they don't realise that the Sonic-driven resurrection of Sega, and that's going to, you know, catapult them into the big time, is going to happen the very year they start looking at its successor. So yeah, you think of the timelines like that, and it probably does give you a bit of an understanding of why there was kind of some friction around what Sega of America wanted to release in 1994 and what Sega of Japan did.
Mm, yeah, I mean, it's that classic loggerheads moment as well. You know, the fact that, again, West versus East, just something that plagued Sega for how long, you know, until they shut up the console shop, basically. But I mean, with Project Saturn, obviously development started before, you know, Virtua Racing. Hideki Sato had confirmed that the Saturn was initially a 2D focused console based on the Sega System 32. Mm. So, you know, Virtua Racing came out sort of in the middle of Project Saturn, so there wasn't many internal Sega developers who had the experience with, you know, polygonal gaming. So the 2D focus at that time, again, coupled with the success of, you know, maybe not in Japan, the Mega Drive didn't do too well, but looking across to what the Genesis was doing in the States after the relaunch, that 2D focus at that time probably did make a lot of sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look at the some of the biggest games that came out on the System 32 and boards that were like that, you know, you look at your Radmobiles and games like Outrunners, which were impossible on current hardware.
Yep.
Before virtual racing, that all kind of made sense. And I think it's, you know, we talk about that Hideki Sato interview right now, which, and it's fantastic on Sega 16, whoever translated it. So brilliant stuff there. But yeah, he talks about the fact that there weren't many developers within Sega who knew how to develop games in 3D. It was, in fact, Yu Suzuki who was pretty much the only one.
That's right. You know, it's the AM teams. And it does kind of, whenever you look at the kind of that interview and you read between the lines and you see what Sato is saying, and that there was almost a sort of fear within Sega, no, do we really want to go down this route? Whereas Yu Suzuki was obviously doing this with the Model 1, and then, you know, Sato's come out later on in that interview and said that one of the prototypes for the Saturn was actually based on Model 1.
Yeah.
Can you imagine the game changer that would have been? You know, that, yeah, that would have been a total quantum shift. I mean, the move to 3D at that time, I mean, you and I being there and playing Sega Rally and Virtua Fighter 2 and Virtua Cop and, you know, Knights and all these brilliant Saturn games that were doing, as it turns out, like kind of pseudo 3D that was being done. But to think that in the bowels of Sega, they were working on a Model 1 based Saturn. And again, was it just that fact that only the arcade guys can use it? So the people who were working on the 2D stuff would be completely left behind. They weren't ready for the jump. So again, it's so much great stuff. If you've not read that interview, we're going to talk about it loads, obviously, in here. But if you haven't, head over to Sega16.com and read the translated parts and have a right good read into it, you know, word for word, because it's absolutely fascinating.
It really is. But, I mean, the technology was moving so quickly then in terms of, you know, the gaming industry, because you had your super scalers back in the 80s, and you had the next generation of them, which is, you know, what the Sega Saturn was going to be based on, your Outrunners, your Radmobiles, and what was it, Ring Edge or whatever that fighting game is called. The name escapes me right now. But then you had Virtua Fighter and Virtua Racing, which are flat shaded polys. But and obviously, there were rumors around the Model 1 CPU being used in the Saturn. Maybe even wishful thinking. But a Model 1 version of Saturn would have been interesting, because it would have been able to push so many polygons. But already by 1994, 1993, you've got texture maps, and it's already, you know, you've got Daytona USA, you've got Ridge Racer out there, and flat shaded polygons are already kind of starting to look, oh, maybe a little bit old hat. So it's a crazy time. You think of all the other home hardware that came in and died. I know so many people. I know the Saturn was not successful, and we know that, and that's part of the reason why we love it and it's so fascinating. But you know, it still performed better than the 3DO, the Jaguar, the Amiga CD32. There's so many that came out in that era where, you know, the technology was advancing so quickly, and it was shifting on a nearly monthly basis which way the industry was going.
Yeah, and I mean that's the thing as well. Whenever you look at the way gaming is today, you know, it's very iterative. You know, it's nice and clean. The jumps are nice and they're cut and dried. You know, the jump between, you know, so everything's all based on where PC graphics cards go is where consoles go now. So you can kind of, you can see ahead of time. I mean, the 3090 Ti's already came out. You know, that was announced. I'm like, they can't even get 3080s and you're putting a 3090 out. You know, it's like scalpers are sitting there going, oh yeah, Dancer. It's very cut and dry, whereas already, if you, the words that we're trying to use here and the kind of the picture that we're trying to paint is that it must have been utterly chaotic at that point in time trying to develop an R&D a console whenever the landscape was at such a kind of a shifting moment. You know, as you're saying, the way games were going, you look at you're going from like your Outrun, you know, Afterburner onto Outrunners, Rad Mobile, you know, all these kind of things. You're moving on to your Model 1 stuff, your Virtua Fighter, your Virtua Racing. Then 2 years later, 93 Daytona USA comes out, which seems crazy that it doesn't seem quite that early 90s, but it was.
It's insane.
And you're looking at those jumps, you know, from like late 80s to early 90s, and then even into the mid 90s, the landscape was just changing so vastly. So in that period between Saturn developing and Saturn launching, The changes in technology were just, it was a deck of cards you had to flung up in there, just try and catch something and hope that you're picking a winner. It was crazy. Whereas you compare today, it's like very cut and dry. Where's PC gaming going? All right, okay.
Yeah.
So we're going with that spec set and that SKU. Right, that's fine. Copy that. It's like, it's very cut and dried and set in stone now, but back then it just sounds like absolute chaos to try and keep track of where everything was meant to be going.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. I mean, even down to the CD and cartridge discussion, you know, they had prototypes for a cartridge console and they had prototypes for a CD-based console. And that was because CD technology in game consoles was new and expensive. And Sega were trying to keep the cost down in having a cartridge-based alternative because they wasn't, you know, again, it wasn't sure which way the industry was going. And I think you make a great point, mate, around how iterative things are now compared to the chaos back then. And yeah, we had at least a trio of consoles that came and went in this generation before the Saturn, PlayStation, N64 landed on the shelves. And even when those three consoles, you know, that are considered to be the key next gen players or that generation players, the N64, the PlayStation and the Saturn all did things in 3D completely differently. And it's probably interesting, probably a good point to jump on now. At some point, while all this development and all these discussions are going on, Tom Kalinske tried to broker an agreement between Silicon Graphics and Sega to use Silicon Graphics graphics chip in the Saturn.
And once again, his friends at Sega of Japan shot down the idea. And obviously, you know, Silicon Graphics would go on and partner with Nintendo. Yeah. And that would be the brain of the N64's graphics, you know. So again, and I think that thing you said there, mate, was spot on. You know, not only did all three of those consoles, the PlayStation, the Saturn, the N64, come at 3D in their own kind of unique way, but as a result of that, they all have a very distinct visual style. Like,
yeah,
you could show me an Xbox game and a PlayStation game, and unless you were kind of familiar with, like, I talk about a AAA, like, if you look at the Falconeer next to God of War, don't give me that comparison. But if you were keeping these new games just now, and you were like, you know, I don't know, Gears 5 beside like God of War, and you didn't know anything about Xbox or PlayStation, if you looked at the two of them, you'd be hard pressed to say which one belonged to a certain platform, because the way that the visuals are done now, it's just such a standardized process. But if you look at a Saturn game, a PlayStation game, and an N64 game, you can tell by looking at them which is which.
Yeah.
They have such a stylized kind of, and it's not down to a decision to look like that. It's because of the way that the machines handle 3D that they're so distinct. You can tell them apart just by looking at them.
Yeah, it's bang on, mate. And we'll get onto why the Sega Saturn looks the way it does later on, but yeah, it's so true. I was actually watching the Digital Foundry 2021 roundup. It's like a 90-minute video of them going through the PS5 and Xbox Series consoles, and they were talking about differences in some games, and that what you just said then, spot on, because unless they didn't have the XS or XX or PS5 logo in the corner, I wouldn't know what version I'm looking at correctly. I mean, all power to those guys. Brilliant at what they do, and they can spot these differences. But I'm looking, you know, I'm looking at my phone, to be fair, but I'm looking and seeing, I don't really see the difference. But you posted the video today, actually, of Wipeout on the Sega Saturn.
Yes.
And I think it's a great port on the Sega Saturn. But it's the way that it looks is very different to the PlayStation game.
Yep, yep.
A lot brighter, maybe a lot more colourful. The PlayStation version is very stylized, very sleek looking. Because that's probably the way that it was intended, based on the PlayStation hardware. But just two versions of the same game that look astonishingly different.
Yeah, and I mean, again, it's the kind of mind's eye thing. I'm loading that up because I got my PS1 long after I got my Saturn, but I did obviously get Wipeout. I think I got it on like the Platinum range or something. By the time I got it, obviously it was a launch title, and I got it like 2.5 years after launch. But I still remember like playing it on the PlayStation, and you could tell it was a bit more responsive and more fluid. The transparencies and the shields were nicer and that kind of thing, but when I went back and played that today, I was just kind of putting some tweets out, just basically going through some Saturn games, and I thought, oh, I'll put some stuff up, and managed to capture a not bad wee recording of some Wipeout gameplay. And while I'm playing it, I'm going, this is exactly how I remember Wipeout. But I think if I was to go and then put the PlayStation version on, I think I would be quite surprised. It is a step above the Saturn version, but that's not to take anything away from the work that Tantalus did, because again, when you realise the difficulties in getting some of these 3D games up and running on the Saturn, it really is, you know, testament to Tantalus that the job they did.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we'll come on to later, there were challenges with it, but yeah, they did a great job. And it's very early days for that port as well. The 2097 port is quite frankly my favourite way to play it, because it has the analog controls. But we'll probably get onto that version in year three. Is it year three? I think it's not 97.
97, right? Yep.
That's right. Yeah, but it's funny that we're talking about Wipeout, because I think the next place that we really need to go is the Sony partnership, which we have spoke about at length to a degree before in our Sony Saturn episode. But some really revealing stuff in the Hideki Sato interview. Obviously, you know, we spoke to Tom about this, and Tom and the Console Wars, but do say that he's the one that proposed the partnership with Olaf Olafsson. And Olaf does seem to confirm that, and it does seem to be confirmed via other sources. But interestingly, Sato seems to say it was Isao Okawa of CSK, who was Sega's parent company at the time, and the Sony head Norio Oga, who actually made the deal for Sony to come aboard. So they came along, and I think it looks like it got further than I understood that it got previously, where Sony actually came to Sega ready to help them out and saw all of the Sega Saturn specs.
Oh, man.
And then, obviously, at some point, you know, Virtua Fighter's come out. Sony have said this needs to be 3D. Sega have been steadfast and kind of been, well, our development teams can only manage 2D. They're only able to do 2D at the moment, and that's kind of where it broke down. And I think licensing was an issue as well, similar to the Nintendo partnership breaking down. That Sony wanted their pound of flesh, so to speak, for being involved. But yeah, that Sony came in and got as far as seeing exactly what their soon to be rivals were making is just that was just a wow moment from me.
Yeah, I think the words that Sato uses are honest to a fault.
Yeah.
They seen Sony as their friendly neighbour. I think they mentioned as well in an interview that they operated only blocks away from each other, so they classed themselves as neighbours, and they had this deal all lined up, and Sega, honest to a fault, showed them, you know, absolutely everything. They showed them the schematics, the specifications for the Saturn, and I think where a breakdown happened, just kind of reading this here, it's, you know, this is talking about fall of 1993. He says, you know, the Sony side was completely free of constraints of worrying about the capabilities of development teams, so they were fully able to embrace polygons. Sato says that when Sega found out about that, we realized that we were in trouble, and at that point, the Saturn only had a single SH2 for its main CPU, so we added a second SH2 to boost the console's processing power. Thankfully, the SH2s could be linked in a cascade connection, and a large amount of geometry calculations are required to do polygon graphics, and the single SH2 was going to be completely insufficient to do that. So, you know, even then, Sato talks about the addition of the second processor. He says it also improved the graphics engine in order to do pseudo 3D graphics. So, you know, again, it comes back to that. How much of what we see when the Saturn does 3D is actually 3D? You know, it's, again, is it a case of you look at it and you go, is it even more miraculous that this machine? I think I appreciate the Saturn even more after reading this, because when you look at Virtua Fighter 2, when you look at Sega Rally, when you look at Virtua Cop, and you look at Knights and Panzer Dragoon Zwei and Panzer Dragoon Saga, and you look at these games and you think, what must these people have been up against to get these games running like that on this hardware?
Absolutely, mate. I mean, you look at things like even Knights into Dreams, Burning Rangers.
Exactly.
I mean, it's all the dominion of the internal teams at Sega, apart from, you know, your lobotomies and your occasional teams that would have worked miracles with the Saturn. But I did laugh a little bit. I mean, it's unfortunate because Hitachi were laughing, weren't they? They were getting two SH2s for every Saturn sold.
Add another one. Stick another one in if you like. Aye, yeah.
Two, one at three, one at four.
I buy one, get one free.
Yeah, that will come back to bite Sega when we get into year one, but because of other reasons as well. But yeah, crazy that they added the second processor. I don't know how you interpreted his talk about improving the graphics engine. So, obviously, what we're saying here is the Saturn wasn't built for a 3D focus. It was 2D focused, okay? So they saw the PlayStation, they saw what it was going to, or they heard what it was going to be capable of, and they added the additional SH2 and improved the graphics engine. Now, if you improve a graphics engine, that would say to me that you're improving the, you know, the layer of code that will enable you to do certain things. So from a... And this is me being a bit of a Luddite and not having a full understanding, but trying to explain what I know. But if you're adding additional compute power via the additional CPU and improving the engine, which I'm assuming is software-based rather than hardware-based, then that would mean that your two VDP chips, which were already in there, because Sega did target a arcade-style multi-processor setup for the Saturn, does that mean that VDP1, which was able to do polygons, was untouched, and that the Saturn could do 3D, but not to the extent that Sega wanted it?
That's a good question. No, I see where you're coming from there. That's a good interpretation. I mean, was the intent to ever port over games like Virtua Fighter in Daytona? You know, again, what kind of level of 3D were we looking at that they put in there? Because as you're saying, they're talking about they improved the graphics engine. And for years, there's always been that kind of wrongful kind of the myth out there. And you need to kind of sometimes correct people. They go, Sega saw the PlayStation and they threw an extra graphics chip in there. And it's like, no. It's an extra processor. But did they bump up the graphics somehow? Obviously VDP 1 and 2, you're saying, were already in there. So if it was software-based, then, yeah, I mean, what element of 3D was already in there? You know, what kind of performance level were they looking at for the Saturn when it came to 3D, bearing in mind that the focus was continuing to be the 2D side of things?
The whole Saturn thing and the whole 32X project as well, and we will get into the 32X more in year one. But we'll get onto the 32X a little bit later in here, actually. But the whole rush to get these out was because Sega were terrified of all things of the 3DO and especially the Atari Jaguar. And they could both do 3D, albeit quite crude 3D, But, you know, the Atari Jaguar ships with Cybermorph, which I know people like to laugh at it and point at it today, but, you know, with a, where did you learn to fly? That whole stuff. I don't know about you, mate, but in 1993, early 94, when I saw that, I was like, wow, I want one of these.
I had a mate who had a Jaguar, and I remember seeing Alien versus Predator on that, and I was blown away.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that. I could not believe how good that looked at that time. I mean, I thought the controller, I didn't like the fact you had to put a wee button overlay thing in the middle. Your game came with like a template that you stuck over your buttons in the middle for that wee. I didn't like that. But I mean, visually wise, I thought the game looked great.
Yeah, it was capable of quite a lot in 3D. So you got to think that was being touted. That was, you know, you first saw that in 93. I'm pretty sure you did. And the 3DO obviously was 93 as well, which, you know, they could do 3D, albeit obviously not as well as the Saturn and certainly not as well as the PlayStation. But Sega, even at that point, must have been acutely aware of the fact that 3D was becoming necessary. You know, Star Fox came out in 1993 to rave reviews on the SNES. They had Virtua Fighter, which was a runaway success in the arcades. They must have wanted to do some sort of 3D, but thought, okay, well, it can do 3D to the same extent that the Mega Drive can do a port of Outrun. Okay, we'll do a serviceable port. No, it's not going to come here and be arcade perfect. It's going to be a serviceable port. So we'll give it enough oomph to do that, but it's going to be primarily a sprite-driven scaling machine, 2D powerhouse. That's my kind of interpretation, that it could do 3D, just not, it's not better than, probably better than the Jaguar and the 3DO, but not, it wasn't the focus. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until they added that additional processor and the compute power and did some software changes to allow it to fully draw on that, that then it made the jump to what Hideki Sato calls pseudo 3D.
So, I mean, you're talking about like the way the Mega Drive could do serviceable ports. It had enough hardware to do like decent but not quite arcade perfect ports of like your Altered Beast, your Outruns, that kind of thing. So, by that kind of rationale, would it be safe to assume that the initial 3D power in the Saturn prior to seeing what Sony were going to be doing would be that the port of Virtua Fighter that was on the 32X would have been the kind of level of port that the Saturn in its original form would have done? So if you're talking about serviceable, it was decent, not fully arcade perfect. I know the Saturn version isn't arcade perfect, right? But I think it's a good port for the time. But the 32X port is noticeably lesser in quality. Still a very good port, but not on par with the Saturn versions. But if you're talking about a serviceable level of port on par with the way the Mega Drive did, the Outruns and the Afterburners, is it safe to say that prior to Sega seeing where Sony were going with the PlayStation, and before they added in the extra processor and before they touched up the graphics engine, that perhaps the 32X port of Virtua Fighter and even Virtua Racing is perhaps an indication of what the Saturn's 3D performance was going to be like, maybe on that sort of level?
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant point, mate, and I'd have to completely agree, because the 32X, and the 32X does share a lot of features with the Sega Saturn, but it doesn't have any of the, you know, the technologies that it does in terms of VDP1, VDP2.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But yeah, I can imagine that the Saturn 3D modeling probably would have looked aligned to how Virtua Fighter and 32X ultimately turned out. You know, it looks good from a distance, and if you haven't seen the arcade game for a while, but the geometry is much reduced. You've got hands which are just basically rectangles or cubes. So yeah, I think that may have been what the Saturn would have been had it not been for PlayStation coming aboard, seeing the specs, saying, no thank you, we're going to do 3D and we're going to do it a lot better than you.
And again, it does come back to that interesting point that Sato said, that, you know, it wasn't, I mean, the way it was kind of put to us by Tom was that he was very, you know, he was very annoyed, and it was one of his kind of personal regrets that he wasn't able to get the deal with Sony over the line. He said his exact words to us were, "What was I not persuasive enough with them? Why couldn't I get it over?" But yet, it seems to be it was the heads of both companies who initially thrashed it out. So again, it's interesting to see that, you know, we've got, you know, Tom's side of things and the angle that he came at it from and from his involvement, and then we're taking, you know, Hideki Sato's words and his kind of take on it. So, as I say, it added a whole new layer of complexion to the entire scenario, the entire picture of the Saturn's development.
Yeah, it really does, mate. And part of me thinks that probably both are true, that it was Ken Kutaragi and Olaf Olesen who were pushing for it. Olaf and Tom thrashed out a deal, took it to their masters in Japan, and knowing how Sega Japan were, probably said, "Oh, thank you, Tom." Not told him anything more about the deal. Brought Sony in-house and did all this stuff and not told anyone in Sega of America about it until the deal fell through.
You know, that I would love it if Tom listened to this and was just sitting there going, "Yes, that just sounds a bit what's right," because I mean, we all know, I mean, the tense relations between Sega of Japan and Sega of America. So again, what you're saying there, mate, I wouldn't be surprised if there was an element of I mean, I certainly believe Tom's side of things. We've seen the kind of fraught relations that he's had all the way through with the, you know, being told to shotgun launch the Saturn at E3. We've spoken about that footage before. The body language of the man is nowhere near the same kind of positive, smiling, grinning, ear-to-ear positivity that we've seen during the Genesis days. So, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if both, maybe Tom thought he was trying to put a deal across, he's thinking, "I can't get this over," but they've already done the deal and tried to do it behind Tom's back, and Sony have already said, no thanks, all right. Well, no bother telling Tom, just let him come in the office and think he's coming. You know, it's just politics, mate, politics.
Absolutely. I can imagine them. Yeah, I mean, Tom took it as far as he could, and so did Olaf, to their ultra secretive Japanese bosses who do a bunch of stuff behind the scenes, ultimately agree it and then break it down and just tell them that it fell through. But that's my hunch. Maybe the truth will come out one day, maybe it won't. But I do believe Tom on this, because obviously his side of the story has been corroborated a bunch of times as well. And the amount of research that Blake Harris put in the book, it's got to side with Tom on this. But I imagine the Sato side of the story has some merit as well. But staying on Tom, it's interesting, in 1993, when, I don't know if you've ever seen any of the concepts for the Saturn, any of the early ones.
I remember the only one I've seen was the kind of metallic looking case. It wasn't as kind of rounded edged. It was very, very razor sharp edges. It had similarities to the Mark One, but it was very kind of almost looked like it was kind of breathing in a wee bit. At the sides, it was very, very sharp edged and quite kind of clinical looking. That's the only one that I've seen.
Yeah, there's this other one that really looks like it just looks like a Discman. with a lot of a lot more on like on the display. Really cool one. But there was an article in there. It was one of those short interviews with Tom, and I was asking about the successor for the Mega Drive and Sega's 32-bit system, and Tom was saying at the time, "Well, we could bring out a 32-bit console today," but he thought at the time that $399 would be too expensive for a piece of home hardware, which probably very prescient of him. But
and then you go 2 years later, they still didn't listen to him.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely. Oh dear. But I suppose if they released it in 1993, it would have been, you know, as they had shown to Sony that year.
Yeah,
Sony
yeah.
Broken away.
Yeah, we can all kind of vastly underpowered at that point compared to what we had. No, I mean, it is interesting, obviously, to think about the fact that they had it ready, you know, ready to go. At that point, they could have went with what they had, but obviously the decision to hold it back a couple of years and go with it, obviously, later on in 1994 in Japan, and then, you know, kind of middle of 1995 in the West, is obviously the right thing to do. I mean, we've spoken already about the kind of PlayStation's focus in 3D and adding that second SH2 in there. But we could move on, I mean, and look at whenever the Saturn was demoed at CES in 94. You know, you had like Virtua Fighter, Clockwork Knight, Panzer Dragoon, Victory Goal, and Daytona USA. And all of those at that time, you know, completely wowed the audience. You know, I mean, Daytona USA, for all intents and purposes, to the naked eye looking at it at that point, would have believed that it was completely arcade perfect. And obviously, looking back at it now, we know it's not. But, you know, audiences were impressed. And bear in mind that the console at that point was in prototype form. And then, if I remember reading in the Sato interview, there was something there about the actual silicon that the Saturn was based on, actual working silicon to be used by developers, didn't get into the hands of anybody until February 94.
Yeah.
So anything that was done, any work that was done essentially in emulators, and this is in CG, like, it was basically fake. It was like CG videos based on what they thought performance was going to be, which, when I read that, mate, I thought, that's the footage that Dan seen of Daytona.
Yeah, I hadn't seen the footage of Daytona. I'd read that.
It was the photographs in the magazine, remember? You said, yeah, that the people that had seen it were saying, oh, this is amazing, it's arcade perfect, I can't believe how good it looks. And I read that quote about the fact that the silicon didn't get into developers' hands until February of 94, which meant that anything that was shown was either emulated or CG. And I'm thinking, those Daytona shots might well have been CG.
I mean, well, from what I read, that ultimately, that everyone coming away from that Daytona reveal and all saying, "Oh my god, it's the Sega Saturn's got a near arcade perfect port of Daytona USA," is because the footage that they showed was actually the arcade version of Daytona USA in that montage. So I found that out recently while doing a bit more of the research for this episode.
So they showed Saturn arcade footage.
Yeah, they showed the arc. So pre-rendered footage of some games and arcade footage of Daytona USA. And at the time, the audiences were amazed. And of course, you would be getting an arcade perfect version of Daytona before we'd actually get one like 20 years later.
just put it what we've got. They'll never know the difference.
But I think that went to CES. Was a pivotal one for the Saturn because it actually had the stage to really impress everyone, because at that time Sony were going back to the drawing board with their PSX project as well, because they'd only just, you know, late 93 they'd stepped away from the Sega deal, and now they were hurriedly putting together their 3D focused PlayStation. But CES 94, the Saturn had its biggest chance to impress, and I think it sounds like it did.
Yeah, I mean, again, audiences were really impressed by what they saw. I mean, in those games, I mean, even if they were in kind of CG form or emulated form or whatever, due to the kind of the silicon not being quite, you know, honed or ready at that point, I mean, those games there, you're talking about VF, you know, Clockwork Knight, which, again, hasn't aged great, but at that time, I mean, it was, again, it's a kind of weird pseudo 3D. I think the sprites actually, like 2D along the lines of like Donkey Kong Country, it's drawn to look 3D, so it's quite kind of clever the way that it's done. Obviously, Victory Goal, you're moving from, you know, sensible soccer and Goal 2 and things like that to something in full 3D with its jazzy rock music as you're scoring a goal. And Daytona, they were games that in the home you'd never seen anything like it. So at that point, 94, you're turning up at CES and you're seeing that level of thing. Of course you're going to be blown away. And that was a real chance for Sega to show that they had a powerhouse on their hands. But obviously Sony were back to the drawing board, and they were, having seen what, you know, Sega were proposing to go with, they held all the kind of trump cards, and they knew exactly what they had to do. They were embracing 3D. But much like Sega's challenges in that they couldn't get the internal teams, apart from the kind of like Yu Suzuki's AM teams, to do 3D. You know, Sony were also kind of struggling to convince, you know, developers to make that jump as well, because 2D had been very profitable, you know, with the Mega Drive and the SNES, and getting those guys to jump over. And ironically, it was Virtua Fighter that, you know, prompted a lot of developers to go, no, this is where we're going. So Sega themselves weren't fully adopting it for the home side, but they did for the arcade, which in turn made developers go, we want to do 3D. That helped a rival who decided to focus fully on 3D, despite the fact that Sega, who made the 3D game that pushed the developers, didn't want to. So it's just... I'm drawing lines in the air while I'm describing that, mate. It's like one of these CSI scenes with a bit of stringing across the wall for different clues. You know, it's madness.
It's like that meme with the guy with the big like map of like conspiracy theory thing, isn't it? But I tell you what, mate, it gets even more knotted now, doesn't it? Because obviously we had CES 94. And they go back to Japan and Sega Japan and Sega America. Me, I think it's Sato and who was the guy that was behind the 32X? But yeah, Sega America are hesitant to jump on the Saturn project. They suggest, in response to Sega Japan saying, oh, how about we create another 32-bit console to follow up with the Mega Drive? And Sega America say, well, absolutely not. let's make it an add-on instead. And hence, in addition to Project Saturn, which is ongoing, Project Mars begins, which ultimately becomes the 32X. And then, again, this will bite Sega when it comes into 1995. But the idea must have been sane sounded good at the time. Is it uses the same SH4 processors, working in tandem as the Sega Saturn?
Oh, I mean, again, and I think that harks back to the fact that, I mean, did Sega really know what direction they wanted to go in? Again, yeah. The idea was is that Sega of America were very happy with the Genesis performance in terms of sales and in terms of popularity. Tom's on record as saying he felt that they could have went another year longer with the Genesis and kept it going. So by putting the 32X on there, obviously it would have, you know, given them that extra bit of 32-bit, you know, power. Maybe some, again, serviceable arcade ports of like your Virtua Fighters and your Virtua Racings, which again would have been on par with the kind of the 16-bit ports of Sega arcade games at the time. But I think given how far along Project Saturn was and the fact that you'd just shown it off, this, I think, is the point where Sega's own fear and confusion, I think, at that time of all this new hardware and where the industry is going, I think it was just a perfect storm. And I think that this is the kind of moment for me that I think where they started to lose the plot. This is where I think the wheel started to come off, because the 32X and the Saturn coming out so close together, 32X being so poorly supported, just, I think, it eroded that kind of trust in the brand, and it gave off the impression that, you know, they don't know what they're doing. You know, why are you bringing out a 32X? And if you've got a 32-bit console coming out, you know, you've showed it off at CES, why are you giving us this? Why should I spend more money on an add-on from a Mega Drive whenever you want me to buy your new system? It just started to throw a lot of kind of conundrums and kind of questions up in the air. So I think this, again, I think it all comes down to the fact that, in my opinion, that they just didn't know. They were trying to cling on to that kind of 2D roots, and we're afraid to move on because of a lack of experience, but also a wee bit of afraid to kind of embrace it. Whereas Sony just went, you know, full steam ahead, ironically, using Virtua Fighter as the catalyst to show this is where we're going.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. And it comes down to the timing, as we said at the beginning. You know, the sound has been in development for nearly 3 years at this point. Overseeing those technological changes in the industry, and seeing a resurgent Sega Mega Drive, particularly in the West, that's turned Sega from into a multi-billion-dollar company in a matter of years. And 1994, the Mega Drive or the Genesis is still going extremely strong, everywhere in the West, just not in Japan, where Sega were desperate to succeed. So you can see why there was friction and why there was so much confusion as to where they should go next. it's interesting because you get to 1994, sorry, to March 1994 when a Saturn shone again, this time nearly finished. Yeah, they still won't confirm whether you can use the cartridge slot to play games. I think I remember reading somewhere that someone thought that the cartridge slot would play 32X games and Genesis games or Mega Drive games. So that was still a mystery at that point.
But I still think there's no way in hell they designed that case and that slot to only take expansion memory. I'm sorry, I can't believe that you put a cartridge slot on the back of a CD-based system when you've just upgraded from a 16-bit cartridge system. It must have been the intention to have backwards compatibility at some point with Mega Drive or 32X. I can't believe that they just put it there as a 4 meg RAM expansion and a memory card slot.
Yeah, it seems like overkill, doesn't it?
I mean, it does. I mean, it's just a big giant. I mean, it's a huge slot right at the back of the machine. You can't miss it. And then, as if to insult you, I'm sure the words expansion memory are printed on the flap as well, just to kind of make sure you don't accidentally try and ram a cartridge in there for a game. It's like, it just seems like overkill, mate. I think somewhere down the line there was plans to make some form of compatibility, and again for budgetary reasons or whatever, they've just went, nah, just stick a memory expansion in there and let them deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, the size of the cartridge just seems like overkill when you look at every other memory card that's ever been made. And I think even you look at the PC Engine CD and the arcade card, I'm pretty sure that gives pretty meaty RAM expansions, and they're just card shaped. I mean, some of them are pretty thick, but they're still, you know, credit card shapes.
Right, exactly.
So I think you're on the money, mate. I think it was rumored that there would be Saturn backwards compatibility with the Mega Drive. A very early rumors even suggested that it was going to use the next generation processor to the Mega Drive, so it would still maintain that backwards compatibility. But obviously, they went with the SH4s instead. So it's probably a hangover from that, maybe from their 32X, maybe from them toying with the idea that they were going to do CDs or cartridges, or maybe CDs and cartridges. So yeah, I think that's just one of those things where someone said, "Do you know what? We've changed so much in this. We're not changing that."
No. I mean, I still think, as you said, use the word then, mate, overkill. I definitely think it is.
Yeah, just reading about the arcade card Duro on the PC Engine CD-ROM, it's 16 megabits, so 2 megabytes. But yeah, it's a credit card size, so you didn't need a giant cartridge for the RAM expansion and for the memory card. It's you just didn't.
At least you get a video CD expansion slot though for an upgrade there.
Yeah, you did. Well, it was also positioned as a multimedia machine as well early on. A lot of that did come true ultimately. But when it came to March, we were seeing the Saturn in its near final form. I think most of the tech demos were very similar to what were being shown before. Yeah. They were also talking about the 32X at the time, or the Super 32X. I can't remember what they were referring to at that point, but they were just openly discussing it. But it was at that point that the very early version of the PlayStation came along and stole the show.
Yes, the PSX, which was quite interesting because I seen a wee kind of tweet exchange a couple of days ago.
I know the one you mean.
I have never heard anyone call the PlayStation 1 the PSX in person. And by the way, that is so spot on. I've never heard any, it's PS, or, but then when PS2 came out, it became retrospectively PS1. There was a PSX magazine, which someone mentioned, but it was a code name, but no one ever walked. You didn't walk into school. What are you doing at the weekend? A couple of hours on Ridge Racer on the PSX. You know, no, nobody had out with that rubbish. No, sorry. So it was a code name, and it kind of, obviously, you did eventually get an actual PSX, that horrible DVD player-looking thing that they brought out. But nobody's ever called it that in real life. But yeah, the PSX... as it was, obviously the PlayStation, two separate words, was the original kind of Nintendo add-on, and then they pushed the words together and put an X on the end as a the kind of code name, and then that's what originally became the original PlayStation. But yeah, that's never they started to show up and started to woo people with their own kind of tech demos, and they started to kind of steal a wee bit of Sega's thunder, and thus the war began, the bragging rights and the boasts all began as well.
Yeah, it did. The one that I always laugh at is where Sony said, we've got 164 third-party developers signed up, and Sega said, well, we've got 178 third-party developers signed up. And I just think of some sort of version of Steve Ballmer jumping across the stage going, developers, 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 developers.
How much would you pay for this? Oh my god, Steve Ballmer, man, what a man.
Oh dear, yeah. Imagine him being in charge of Sega, that would have been something to behold.
If he might have got somewhere. We sweaty pits and over enthusiasm, but how did they got there?
He would have got there. He would have got there. But yeah, the boast, mate. Yeah, the developers one always makes me laugh. The polygon count. Oh god, I remember reading this so much in magazines that the Saturn could do 30,000. No, it can do 90,000. Well, the PlayStation can do 150,000. Well, the Saturn can also do 150,000. Well, the PlayStation can also do 300,000. And yeah, it turns out that all of that was complete bollocks from both of them. I think they could get like to just over 100,000 polygons if they were like flat shaded, but once you added textures and all that sort of stuff, it just wasn't the case.
This just reminds me of the Lesser Watch episode of Only Fools and Horses. It's like the number get up every time. The polygon rate now stands at 4 million. Oh Jesus Christ! No, aye, about 100,000 flat shaded is kind of more realistic. But it was just crazy. Just listening to these kind of boasts. I mean, the numbers. It's like 164. We've got 178. It's like, I mean, you just wonder where they were pulling. Like, you could just go a couple more above it. You're just pulling random numbers out there. It's like mad, mental, but. How much of that was actually spurred on by, you know, A, Sony kind of being kind of spurred on by the fact that they'd walked away for that deal and had seen everything. So they knew fine well, you know, what Sega had, and then obviously what they didn't quite know what they had boosted it to, but they knew the capabilities that they'd be able to go to, and they knew it wouldn't match what they had.
Yeah.
So they're kind of knowing quite confidently, well, we can say this. Knowing that anything else they come back with won't touch it, but aye, and then Sega will be a bit maybe stung the fact that their friendly neighbours that they showed everything to have decided to rival them and go their own way and do their own product. So it was a wee bit of kind of pride clashing, I think, from both sides.
Yeah, yeah. It all sorts of things like Saturn can do in more colours, but yeah, I think it is exactly what you say, mate. Pride from both sides. I don't think there was much animosity between them.
No, I don't get that feeling, no.
Especially at this stage. They were kind of rivals.
Right.
I think there was genuine friction between Sega and Nintendo in this period, especially, you know, after we spoke to Tom and reading the Console Wars book. But Sega and Sony, you know, they tried to work together. Obviously, that fell through. It seemed more like a rivalry at this point, and more of a friendly rivalry. And, you know, two mates, you know, it sounds a bit like my dad can beat up your dad, doesn't it? A little bit.
Sato and Kutaragi kind of like... jumped out for a bit of lunch and a bit of dinner, which they did say in interviews, something that they did.
They
caught up and kind of, you know, Kutaragi would kind of, you know, jokingly, or quite straight faced, but jokingly say, you know, just, you know, come work for us, come make games for us. You don't want to be doing that, you know, try to kind of get some wee jibes in there and things like that. And obviously it did actually end up happening, which is a bit of a, you know, irony. But yeah, I don't think the animosity actually started until Steve Race in 299.
Yeah.
I think that's when the needle started, I think.
I think so. I think so as well, especially since, you know, Sony in America, Sony Computer Entertainment America was comprised a lot of Saturn, ex-Sega employees. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's probably when they knew. But at this stage, I think it was very much friendly banter, a bit of rivalry between two neighbors, effectively. I
said, turn that music down.
I'm trying to get some sleep.
Turn that radio of yours off.
So we're getting kind of close to the final throes of the Saturn development now. So the final design is revealed, you know, in the autumn of 94. The note on it I've got in here is that most of the attention went to the 32X when the final design was revealed. That console still in Sega's thunder. It's amazing.
It turned out to be such a span on the works, and it's the fact that they caused it themselves.
Yeah.
You know, just their own kind of fear and uncertainty and doubt kind of led to this pariah of a product that kind of... See if they just not done 32X at all, I just think things might have been a wee bit different. I just think there was just... Aye, it was just... People, it was something new. Oh, what's that? Something new for Sega. Let's go and check that. Oh, what's that? That's new. The Saturn. No, leave that and we'll go and check the 32X. It's like, what?
Yeah, I think I've mentioned before that I always wanted a 32X when I first saw one, because I thought that was the affordable way to get into the next generation. And I initially started saving for a 32X, but obviously
sorry to cut you off. It was the Series S of the 32-bit generation.
No, the Series S is a lot more well thought out. It's a lot more, there's a lot more support. I mean, there's already more games optimized for the Series S than there were for the entire lifespan.
Whenever you said a more affordable way, I thought, there we go. The 32X was a Series S, the Saturn was a Series X. There you go.
Oh, maybe the 32X was ahead of its time conceptually, mate. So. Oh dear. Yeah, I wanted one so badly. But obviously by the time that I'd saved up enough money to buy one, there were 25 quid in the bargain bins and the thing had been abandoned. And so I carried on saving towards a Saturn.
Mental.
But yeah, I could see maybe why it was like a good idea, but I think it, as we can see already, it's already taken eyes away from the Sega Saturn.
Yeah.
And as we get into the pre-US launch, when we get into year one in our next episode, we'll see that it has a very real impact on the Saturn itself.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's taken eyes away here. But they did confirm at this stage that the release date was set for Japan on the 22nd of November. Yeah, go on, mate.
Yeah, I mean, and again, that whole thing again, we're talking about 22nd of November, 1994. Now, we've already discovered through these interviews with Sato and things like that, that the silicon wasn't ready until February 94, you know. So you're looking at this this is a console that, again, as a project, started in 91, but you didn't get silicon finalized until February of 94, and then you're launching in November of 94 in your home territory. So, again, crazy, a crazy time period there to get everything out there and ready. But despite, you know, all of the kind of the challenges and the 32X taking the eyes off the Saturn, the unveilings and things like that, that the Saturn still, you know, sold 500,000. Was it 500,000 that there was available? Or 200,000 were available at launch. And it sold out instantly. You know, Virtua Fighter selling, you know, one for one with consoles. You know, so crazy to think that despite all this kind of hassle and the protracted, you know, drawn out kind of development period and the challenges with the deals with Sony and having to add in all this extra processing power, upgrade the graphics engine, getting the silicon late, getting your launch date there, but still, there was enough confidence in the product in the home territory that, you know, they sold out at launch, and Virtua Fighter being, again, as always has been in Japan, has been a massive, massive seller for Sega.
Yeah, mate, I think you've nailed it there, because, you know, if you've if anyone's listening and they don't know too much about the Sega Saturn, but the commonly accepted narrative is that the Sega Saturn was a flop, obviously a failure. And they're listening to you and I are talking about this and going, well, they changed. It's been in development since 1991. They've had to change the hardware so many times. They didn't even know what they were doing with the cartridge slot a few months ago. You know, the 32X, everyone's more interested in the 32X at this point than they are the Sega Saturn. Development's only started in February. They're trying to get, they're boasting things with the PlayStation that they can't even back up. I bet it's a flop right out of the gate. Amazingly, and again, we're talking about the Sega Saturn launching in Japan, which at this point is Sega's least successful territory.
Yes.
Where they have been trying unsuccessfully to depose Nintendo. For, well, the SG-1000 and the Famicom launched in 1983, 84. This is a decade they've been fighting and losing, being dominated by Nintendo. And after, if anyone's listening to this, they must be thinking, when it gets to Japan and the place where Sega have never been successful, with all this drama in the background, with all these changing hardwares and everything, surely it must be a flop. And that it was Sega's biggest console launch ever in Japan.
Yeah.
Pre-orders were completely sold out in up to 2 weeks in launch. The V Saturn, which was a JVC variant, was absolutely impossible to find. It sold out pretty much instantly, with Virtua Fighter selling one-to-one with it, which is absolutely bonkers when you think about it.
Aye. I mean, again, and the reviews in Japan as well were all positive. You know, the Famitsu, you know, the fiercest of critics in Japan, the legendary reviewing kind of panel, they've got four reviewers, each one gives a score out of 10, then you get your kind of aggregate score out of 40 at the end. They've never changed. And again, you know, all positive stuff, you know, the controller, the UI, user experience, all hailed at that time as superior to PlayStation 1. The Virtua Fighter port at the time, also very well received. And again, in 2022, as we are in now, but you know, it's an ongoing kind of battle you've got with people who kind of, you know, maybe lambast the Virtua Fighter port on the Saturn. But again, as we've spoken about so many times on this show, to see that, you've got to go back to, I just say it again, July 8th, 1995, launch day, the day that I seen that running when Munko surprised me with the Saturn. It's a day I will never forget, because the day he opened that door, that was the arcade version of Virtua Fighter that I seen that day. And, you know, the magic and allure of that. And you can nitpick and the individual fingers aren't on the fighters. And it's not quite, there's not as many polygons making up the fighters, and there's a wee bit of clipping, and some of the timing on some of the moves is a wee bit off. Like Akira's double kick, the second kick doesn't always connect. There's a wee bit kind of glitchy at times there. But in the main, it is an excellent port, and it was well received in Japan. And that point you made there as well, Dan, about this kind of decade-long battle with Nintendo, is that despite the Saturn was a failure, right? Like, we're not trying to kind of paint the Saturn up to be this massive success, right? But the facts are there that it did sell out in Japan at launch. It was massively successful in Japan. It still remains to this day Sega's most successful Japanese console. That's why it's still lauded in Japan to this day by Sega fans and Sega themselves, because it's the Sega system that beat Nintendo in Japan. Mega Drive didn't do it. Dreamcast didn't do it. It was the Saturn that done it, and for that reason, it's got that wee special kind of place in Japanese, you know, Sega fans and Sega execs' hearts. So, yep, at launch, despite all the trials and tribulations of development, it was a massive hit at launch.
It was. It's funny because Sega somehow knew that they had a winner on their hands, and it probably comes down to the fact that Virtua Fighter was so popular in the arcades then. Obviously, it was big enough to drive the structure of the PlayStation, and Sega knew it was big enough to, you know, to launch the Saturn aside. And obviously, as you said, mate, it sold one to one with the console. But it's quite amusing because Sega had 500,000 consoles available,
yeah,
but only released 200,000 at launch, which is why it sold out so quickly. Saved the other 300,000 consoles for the week that the PlayStation launched. So when the PlayStation launched, Sega had this deluge of stock that they just unleashed.
So that's where the 500,000 to 200,000 two numbers came from. It was 500,000 available, 200,000 at launch, and they kept back 300,000 for the PlayStation launch. Yeah. Clever.
Yeah, so when the PlayStation launched, there wasn't a bunch of empty shelves where, you know, the Sega Saturn had been sold out and wasn't available. It was then sold right next to the PlayStation. And yeah, you're talking about the reviews to it, mate. The controller and the UI and the user experience has always been something that that I've been. It's part of what attracted to me the Saturn in the first place. Yeah. The controller has always been fantastic. And the UI, I think we've spoke about the UI before on this pod, but the whole menu, the way that the way that it comes in, you've got the clock and all the background menus and everything. But when you get to that splash with with the endless stars and everything, and you've got the buttons and the dials for the CD controls, and if you hide them, then you've got the spaceship that comes up, and then you get rid of them, don't you, to get for the spaceships going.
The noises that buttons make. Yeah. If you go from the kind of first menu to the second menu, it goes bloop, bloop.
Yep.
And then that one you did there, whenever you start the game, boom.
Yeah. But when you collapse them, when you spread them all out, it's like whoop, when they all go out. And you see the spaceship, and then you can bring him back, and it's like, ring.
That's right. It goes, that's not Chewbacca there, isn't it?
Oh, but it's beautiful. And by comparison, the PlayStation UI was just so clunky and unresponsive and just so dry.
Mate, do you know what I used to love in the Saturn's UI, right? This is just so cheesy. But I used to, like, I never got to see Michael Jackson live. Right? This is a tangent and a half, by the way. I never got to see Michael Jackson live, right? But you know yourself, when you play an audio CD in the Saturn, you can change, you can add echo.
Yeah.
So yeah. I used to play my Michael, I had my Saturn hooked up to my hi-fi at the time. I used to put my Michael Jackson CDs in and actually, like, make them sound live by adding echo. I used to love listening to my CDs like that because it was kind of pseudo live effect. And again, there you go. No other console I've done that way since to do that. So I used to love that. But the UI was brilliant. It was really, it was colourful. It had all these kind of wee hidden kind of wee noises and the features that you could collapse it and have the big 3D polygon spaceship, you know, rotate and then get into distance and coming back, and the big blue thrusters on it as well. Just absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely beautiful, mate. It's just so amazing. I used to mess around with the pitch and everything and myself, and just make my music CDs just sound all weird.
Chipmunks.
Yeah, I spent ages doing that. But yeah, I mean, even the controller as well. I mean, the Saturn controller at this point is legendary for, you know, it's how it's used in fighting games and everything else. And it's probably worth pointing out at this stage that it's the original Japanese controller, which would turn out to be kind of the Model 2 controller in the West, not the controller that it launched with here and in the US.
That was a weird one, the fact that they redesigned the controller. I mean, don't get me wrong, at the time I used the PAL controller, it was a kind of more curved front, but I could never, the D-pad with the kind of circles, the up, down, left, right, kind of, it was quite kind of strange, but the Mark II PAL controller, which is identical to the Mark One Japanese controller, is for me the comfiest, best controller I have ever used. It's the one I use for my Saturn just now, and again, just it's so comfortable. It's just the right size. It's not too small, not too big. The 6-button layout, nice clicky shoulder buttons, an absolutely brilliant D-pad. And that lovely wee oval shaped rubber start button as well, with its wee dimple.
Yeah, mate, I agree. It's probably my favourite controller of all time. I've actually gone with the old Retrobit wireless pads at the moment.
Yeah,
I had the dongle for the Saturn, obviously. So they're really good, actually. They feel really authentic. So I've been using the wireless pad on the Saturn for a while now, but the wife got me the Mega Drive adapter for Christmas. And the thing about those pads is they just feel so quintessentially Sega.
Yeah,
that it still feels authentic using that pad on a Mega Drive, using it wirelessly. It's just so comfortable. Obviously, 3D games that need an analog pad, you know, unfortunately, you have to put it to the side. But for anything else, perfection.
Right. Lie up on the couch, feet up, no cable, just sit as far away as you need to for your Saturn. That's you. You're sorted.
Yep, absolutely, mate. So, yeah. So obviously they were reviewing the controller, the UI and everything, and were raving about it. I mean, one thing they do note about the controller is that the leads were longer. So you're talking about wireless there. The PlayStation original in Japan, they had really short wires to its controllers, which a lot of people didn't like. Mm. And I think the other thing that came into the conversation at this point was, and we'll probably touch on this when we talk about the Western launches in the next episode, was that although the PlayStation was, I think, about 10,000 yen cheaper than the Saturn, obviously that didn't come with any sort of memory card that you had to buy separately. And Virtua Fighter, in a lot of instances, was bundled with the Saturn for that price.
Yep.
So you were getting possibly an even better deal with the Sega Saturn in those instances. And that was another thing that outlets were reporting at the time.
Yeah, we will go into that in more detail for the next episode, 100%, because, yeah, the whole 100 quid price difference was not the case at all, whenever you compare specs and games and stuff like that. But that's another topic for another day. But, yeah, the price difference was certainly manipulated to a point, 100%.
It's interesting that Japan at this stage definitely saw it the other way around. But yeah, I think that brings us to the end of year zero then, mate. We've hit the launch of the Sega Saturn in Japan. And by the end of 1994, 500,000 Saturn sold, just 300,000 PlayStations. Surely setting Sega up for a Sega Saturn success story.
You would think so, mate. Nothing could go wrong, mate. That's it. I mean, they've sold out 500,000 of their stock already. They're heading into, you know, Christmas period. They've got the number one arcade smash ported faithfully. Rave reviews from Famitsu. The UI's great. The controller's great. PlayStation controller's hellish. Sorry, I've never liked the PS1 controller. They gave me cramps and my hands. What could go on, mate? They're set up for success despite all the trials and tribulations. They've done it. They've launched. They've sold out. Here we go.
Yeah, what could go wrong? But we'll save that for next time, where we'll talk about the Western launches, the trials and tribulations then. And I think, mate, we'll be talking about the games at that point.
Yeah, we'll be getting into the fun stuff, the glorious games, the launch lineup. We'll compare the launch lineups as well. You sent me some very interesting stuff about the early months as well. It's quite remarkable, again, media perception of how barren PlayStation's launch lineup was compared to the Saturn in the months that followed. But we'll go into that in more detail in the following episode. This has been an absolute blast, mate. I can't believe that's an hour and 20 odd minutes of an episode that's just flown by.
Yeah, it really has, mate. But I think I kind of expected it to, because, as I say, when we was going through the interview, when we were putting our notes together, when we were talking about this, we were over WhatsApp going, I can't wait to talk about this with you. Can't wait to go through this. And yeah, I've been really looking forward to it since we said that we'd try and get this in, mate. I've enjoyed it so much. And I hopefully you have as well.
No, 100%, mate. I say it's an episode in a series that has been on the back burner, I would say, since maybe just after summertime. I think we put this out and we said that if we're going to do it, we need to, you know, get all our kind of figures and our dates and everything all in order, because it's you're talking about going through in chronological order, you know, the life of a system from development through to discontinuation. So I've absolutely loved it, mate. I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah, neither can I, mate. So, listeners, I hope that you've enjoyed listening to this as much as we've enjoyed recording it. Maybe you've learned a little something. I know that I learned an awful lot looking into the history and the development of the Sega Saturn, not to mention the two Hideki Sato interviews. So massive thanks to the guys at Sega 16 for those translations. Those interviews were stunning. Thanks again as also to the guys at Sega Retro. So much information on there. Fantastic stuff. But guys, had an absolute blast recording this one. Hope you enjoyed it as much, and hope you're looking forward to the next episode, 1995, the Sega Saturn years, year one. So until next time, stay Sega and stay retro.
Cheers, guys.